From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm David Andrietta, in for Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is being made in workplaces all across America, perhaps around the globe, as employers grapple with how to address the myriad and complex feelings and perceptions their employees harbor about racial injustice and the unrest in the streets. These are tumultuous times, and emotions are all over the map. On any given day, the headlines can have any thinking person vacillating between feelings of hopelessness and optimism, anxiety and empowerment, despair and resolution. I've been there. You've been there. We've all been there. While racism in the United States is as old as the country itself, the movement in corporate America to confront it and encourage employees to talk about race is relatively new, and it has left companies and organizations from Wall Street to Main Street grasping at straws to facilitate productive conversations. Here in the WXXI family, we've been having these discussions, and this hour, we're going to do something a little bit different. Rather than hear from a panel of outside experts, we're turning the microphones inward here in the studio and inviting you, the listener, into that conversation. And not because we have all the answers, not because we're doing it perfectly, but because, like many of you, we're searching for the answers too and are groping through the process. And maybe, just maybe, by giving you a chance to hear what some of the conversations we've had sound like, with our sometimes stuttering starts and pregnant pauses and backing up, we can help you see that you're not alone in your awkwardness in talking about these sensitive but critically important matters. Maybe you own or work for one of these companies that is wading into this conversation. We want to hear from you. Tell us what has worked. Tell us what hasn't. What obstacles have you had to overcome? Have you yet to have that conversation? Perhaps this episode will be your icebreaker. We invite you to call us at 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994. Of course, you can always email the program at connections@wxxi.org. I, for one, have found the conversations helpful, and I am delighted and humbled that three of my colleagues, whose voices you don't get to hear on the air very often, but who make this family run, have agreed to join me. We couldn't do this without them. In studio with me is Mona Isler, Executive Assistant and Staff Liaison to the Board at WXXI, who does, like everything around here. Mona, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And because we're following the experts' advice on physical distancing during the health crisis, to Shonda Thomas, the head of human resources at WXXI, and Laura Garrison, the vice president for development at WXXI and the Little Theater, are joining us by phone. To Shonda, I'm so glad that you're here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And Laura, many thanks for being part of this conversation.
A pleasure, always.
Tashonda, I want to start with you. And first of all, let me say, you know, this, I don't want this to necessarily be the peppering with questions, like I'm going to be the moderator here. I know I have that role here as fill-in host for Evan Dawson today, but I want to have the conversation. I want to try to recreate that conversation that you facilitated last week when we had this discussion. So let's start with you, because you're the person who got the conversation around here going with an email to the entire staff, I guess a few weeks ago now. And the pitch was straightforward, and I'm going to quote from it. Quote, in recent weeks, we have had a number of events both nationally and locally that have been tough to deal with and understand. We would like to talk about these events and issues on race, equity, and social justice. What moved you to prompt these sessions, and what were the goals that you were hoping to accomplish?
So what prompted me to have these sessions was, you know, being African American myself. I'm a mom, I'm a wife, I'm a daughter, and just seeing everything that was happening. I know everybody right now knows the George Floyd story, but also Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and I think with just everything going on both locally and nationally, everything started to weigh really, really heavy on me. And it just so happens we were having one of our leadership meetings, and I kind of just let it out. You know, I shared with, you know, my colleagues, both Mona and Laura were on the call that day as well. And we were just talking about everything that we were doing as far as informing the community about what's going on, both locally and nationally, but I really wanted us to understand the importance of tapping into our people internally within WXXI City and the Little Theater. because I think it's really, really important that when we have these sort of events and things going on, that we connect with each other to just see how we are doing. And I didn't really see us doing that, and no fault, you know, to us. We know sure. what we know, you know.
Well, but like I said at the top of the hour, this is an imperfect
exactly.
process.
You know. Exactly.
So yeah. So go on. You're saying that you know, you didn't see us doing that here in
yeah.
know.
So yeah, and I thought that it would be important for, you know, I knew that I wasn't the only one that this was weighing really, really heavy on. So from that conversation, you know, we said, well, let's just do, you know, some listening sessions. And that's what we did. And I was aware that we had, you know, listening sessions done before, but we did it a little differently where we didn't bring in anyone, you know, from the outside. We kept it definitely internal. And I just really didn't have very high expectations. I just knew we should get the conversation going. I wasn't sure how many people would even be interested, but I was super surprised that we had almost, I think, over 60 people that actually, I think Mona can actually add to this too, that joined the conversation. And it was absolutely great. And one of the highlights was at the end of this, everyone was saying, we needed more time.
Yeah.
You know, so that kind of told me that we really enjoyed, you know, talking about this. We really got deep in, you know, what was happening.
And that is one of the reasons that I wanted to have to devote this hour to this conversation. I want to get back to something you said about mm-hmm. all of the recent events weighing heavily on you. And I know that
yeah.
as human resources director, employees come to you with concerns, with problems. I don't want you to break any confidences, but you had also right. said that you knew that you weren't the only one going through this. Have employees come to you? Have they, you know, have you talked to other people in human resources that you know of in other local companies or elsewhere mm-hmm. that have seen an influx of people coming in to talk to the human resources director to help them deal with understanding, grasping what's going on right now in our world?
Absolutely. So, it, you know, it's not so much people come in for, you know, assistance or guidance. It's just they just want to talk about what's happening because it's just so much going on. I think, you know, for me, when someone comes to me and they're like, hey, you know, this is what I saw on the news, and we really start to have that dialogue, you know, it could be someone coming to me and quite frankly saying, I didn't even really realize this was happening. I didn't know that you as a Black mom having a 19-year-old son has, you know, have this sort of fear for your son, you know, so it's just really connected on a completely different level with your colleagues. And I know for HR professionals, we are kind of told early on, you know, keep it strictly, you know, business, quite frankly, you know, you don't go deep in people's business. They share what they want to share. But I think, and I shared this during my listening session group, that, you know, we are probably going to break the mold here a little bit, because how can you not go deeper than the surface of just the work when you have things like this happening outside of the workplace?
Yeah, and I want to,
you know?
Exactly. I know exactly what you're getting at. And I thought it was something that really helped me. I mean, gosh, I've worked at big companies before. This is a very small company compared to where I've been before. And, you know, we've gotten the emails from corporate, and it sometimes feels like a box checking exercise, to be honest
right.
with you, as an employee of a large company. And that is something that this could have felt like. It could have felt mm-hmm. like that, but it didn't. It really
right.
felt personal, and I felt like there was a personal connection there. And I would encourage any company that is we're all struggling with what's going on today and understanding it, and I would encourage any company to have these types of sessions. So could you explain
yeah.
for our listeners the structure of our sessions? There's no shortage of advice. You know, in preparing for the show today, I went online looking for how to talk to employees or what other companies are doing, you know, about talking to their employees about race and racial injustice.
Mm-hmm.
There's no shortage of advice, easily found mm-hmm. online, and they offer these frameworks for these discussions. They use lingo like dialogue circles and town halls and breakout workshops, and you called yours a listening session. Why? And secondly, mm-hmm. what was the structure? So anyone listening who's thinking about doing an exercise like this can have an idea of what we did here.
Sure. So I will first start with just saying that, you know, employers, to me, you have a responsibility to even have these sort of conversations with your staff. I think sending out, you know, a message on what your stance is great. But I think unless you tap in to really feel the temperature of how people are feeling about what's happening, you know, the message can really get lost. But for us, you know, fortunately for me, I have some great HR mentors and other HR professionals that I connect with regularly that have done these sort of listening sessions or whatever, you know, you want to call it at their organizations. And it's just talking through what worked for them, what didn't work, and then kind of tweaking the information that I have to fit what I think is a perfect match for WXXI, right? Mm. So for me, I knew that, okay, yes, I don't have the expectation of, you know, I want this certain amount of number of people to kind of register and partake in this. But if we were to have, you know, 50 people, do I want all 50 people at once answering these questions? Probably not. You know, I want this to be successful and really have people walk away feeling that, you know, one, I feel empowered to do something. Two, I really have a better understanding of what's happening and understand what my role in is in being, you know, that change agent. And so I decided to do breakout sessions. So we had, you know, no more than 8 or 9 people in each group. And I think, you know, having that intimate conversation on a smaller scale, it just really, really worked for us.
And I want to stress it was by video conference, too.
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely virtual at this point.
Sure. You know, when I was a young reporter, I got advice from more than one editor, you know, never to ask someone, how are they feeling? How are you feeling? You know,
yeah.
How do you feel about this? How do you feel about that? You know, you want to elicit answers about really what was going through their mind. So, you know, what was your first thought when XYZ occurred? Or what went through your mind when XYZ occurred? And also, people have a very difficult time describing emotion. But I was struck that in our session, the first question you asked, and then Mona touched on it when she was the leader of my breakout session, we're going to talk to Mona in just a second, was how do you feel?
Mm-hmm.
How are you feeling about recent events? And it goes to exactly what you said to Shonda a few moments ago about how you went beyond the all business, you know, HR hat that you might typically wear. And I found that I was actually shocked at the torrent of responses. And I was relieved because I found that there were people feeling the same way I was feeling. I mean, I, for one, have felt, I use words like disenchanted and disappointed. And we all come from different backgrounds, right? I grew up in Canada. The unrest that we're seeing now, and that the unrest that we saw in the 1960s, the unrest that we saw in the early 1990s, these were not Canadian problems, if you will. And that's not to suggest that there isn't racial inequity in Canada or in other parts of the world. Obviously, we're seeing these types of rallies around the world now because other countries are finding solidarity with this movement because there are injustices there, of course. But it wasn't something that was top of mind, perhaps. That was because of the place I grew up, predominantly white. I don't know. But the point is, is I always thought of the United States as sort of this very special place where big things happen and big problems get solved. And this seems to be a persistent problem that has no solution, or at least feels that way to me. And it's very disappointing for me. So I want to turn the I'm going to ask Mona now. Actually I'm going to turn to Laura Garrison. I was struck. We were in the same listening session that Mona Isler, who's with us in studio, was the leader of. And I was struck by your answer as to how you're feeling, because it was a little bit different than mine. How are you feeling?
Well, I am disappointed. I am a child of the 60s, so I grew up, you know, demonstrating and trying to organize for all kinds of different things, including racism, being against it and everything else like that. And I never really thought about it again. As you, I grew up in a white suburb, and I did not really understand racism. And I kept on saying, oh, I'm not a racist. I know I'm not a racist because I'm colorblind. Everyone's the same. And it wasn't until after I adopted a child who is a person of color that I understood a little about what racism really is. And I think that it's incumbent upon all white people to learn about racism, because it is, and my guess is that you're probably racist too. And you can say in yourself you're not racist, but when you think about what it is you're doing and what it is you're not doing, it's very specific. And if you talk to people and do some reading too, you know, my favorite book at the moment happens to be Ibram Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist. And I think that that tells me something, where basically one of his principles is that by not taking an action in the face of racism, it's a form of racism.
Right. It's not enough to just not have hate in your heart.
Correct.
Right.
That's what I'm trying to say, is that, you know, you really have to take actions out there to fight against racial inequality. And not only racial inequality, every inequality, but specifically right now we're talking about racial inequality. And I think that that's what strikes me, is that you have to really think about that. And it's an education matter in the cases of some people who are white. And I certainly think that, you know, if you have a question, my son is constantly telling me if I have any micro or major aggressions or anything else like that, because I want him to. I don't want to be insensitive. I don't want to say something stupid. I don't want it to sound like I am being a racist. So he tells me all the time. And I think that's been very helpful to me, because it's portrayed a lot of things. And I mean, you know, when you think about it, this country was sort of founded on racist principles. I mean, unless you were a white man of property.
There's no question about that. I don't think it's anything that it's well documented at this point.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's not something we need to really think about. It's there. Yeah.
It's just there. And you need to fight against it, because there should be equality, and everyone needs to fight for that.
I want to open up the phone lines to invite you again to join the conversation, as awkward as it may be, but that is the point. You know, maybe you've struggled with having this conversation at work and are looking for advice. We'll give you the best advice we can. No one is an expert. We're all reaching around right now for the right approach here. But I encourage you to share your stories with us. Tell us what has worked, what has been an obstacle, what hasn't worked. You can contact the show at 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994. Or by calling 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Of course, you can always email the program at connections@WXXI.org. Mona Isler, you were the leader of the group, the breakout group that I was in, the listening session, if you will. You're facilitating conversations between high-level executives all the time, but this was different. This was a conversation between colleagues, some from various parts of the building who don't interact with each other a lot. Were there special challenges in this setting to getting people to open up? How did you do it?
Well, I think for me, the first thing I wanted to do was to establish that...
And you were great, by the way.
Thank you. to establish that everybody needs to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. It is only in the space where we are talking about things that make us uncomfortable that we can really look inwardly and be open to hearing things that might change behavior or thoughts, minds, etc. I also was the only African American in the group, and I was determined I was not going to treat anyone with kid gloves. But also that I was going to facilitate this room by leading with compassion. And that means is that, as trite as it sounds, we want to make sure that everybody knew it was a safe space that we were in, and that the nine of us were going to have some honest, real conversation about how we're feeling, what can we do, what's happening, what's going on with you. And, you know, one of the first people to start speaking was she was so upset about not only the state of the world, but the helplessness that she was feeling. And, you know, for me, it was just about, look, this is a safe space. We're going to talk. We're going to address some things. And I didn't have to do anything to get anybody to talk.
I was really surprised at that.
Floodgates were open from the beginning.
it was astonishing to me because, again, as I said at the top of the hour, this could have felt like a box checking exercise. You know, this could have felt like some sort of corporate exercise, and it wasn't. But I attribute that to folks like you, to Tashonda, whoever else was running those breakout sessions. So let me turn the tables on you, because I thought you I thought you summed up your feelings really, really well and got that ball rolling. How are you feeling about the situation?
Well, when Tashonda...
The situation. Right. Like there's just one little situation. Right.
When Tashonda asked the question in the broader group, how you're feeling, my response is tired.
Yeah.
You know, and I reiterated that in our small group. I'm tired because I've been talking about race my whole life. I'm about to be 52 years old. And this has been in front of me every day of my life. And I'm not trying to play victim, but it's there. It's not, you know, and learning how to navigate the world as a Black person and additionally as a Black woman, that's always been there. This isn't anything new for me. And so I really, in terms of the group, was about, this is what I'm feeling. This is what I've experienced. This is, you know, how, you know, this feels different to me now. I mean, it's very reminiscent of the 60s. I was born, you know, at the tail end of the 60s. And I really just needed to, you know, say, I've done all the talking I need to do. It's time for you to talk. It's time for this group to have a conversation.
There's someone on the line who I think might agree with you. We have Kevin in Victor. And Kevin, I'm going to put you on the air right now. Kevin, are you with us?
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Well, yeah, like
welcome
I told
to
the
Connections.
Screener, okay. When I told this, like I told the screener, I was very involved in, very interested in the plight of Black people in the 60s and early 70s when I was a young man. I worked with the Black Panthers, and I believed in their cause back then and still do looking back. But I believe that a lot of the fixation on race that we're going through now is really unhealthy, because America today is not the same as it was back when the Black Panthers formed. And a lot of the rhetoric coming, especially through the media and social media, I think is just blatantly untruthful. I think that most Blacks and whites really like each other and get along. And this idea that structural racism and white supremacy and all these things are everywhere and just smothering people, I just think that's false.
Kevin, thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Mona, what's your take on that?
Well, whenever you are confronted with somebody who has that perspective, the most important thing, I think, is for Kevin to recognize that his reality and my reality both have value. What has occurred in society since we came to these shores in the 1600s is real. What is happening systemically in terms of how long we've been fighting for justice and equality in this country, that's real. Extrajudicial murders by the cops, that's real. And though it may not be his reality, it is important to recognize that if I say this is real, then I need you to recognize that it's real and to lead with, it's not my experience, but your reality matters to me. What you're saying matters to me. It's important for me to see what you're saying. And you can't walk in my shoes, but you can certainly be empathetic about what we're experiencing.
You know, we're getting to an uncomfortable moment, and that's okay, because we need to be comfortable with being uncomfortable. And I want to talk, I want to turn it back to Laura. You know, you'd said something about your son. May I ask, how old is your son now? Laura, are you with us? We may have lost Laura here.
Oh, I'm here.
Oh, she is. Okay, Laura.
Okay, I'm here.
How old is he? How old is your son?
He's 31 now.
He's 31. Okay. And so you said, you know, he will often tell you, "Mom, you're being racist," or "That's racist."
Right.
And of course, it's I'm assuming it's done in a non-judgmental way.
Oh no. Oh no. Oh no.
All right. No. But tell me more.
He's right out there. You know, part of it is that, you know, I think that when you grow up, when you have someone in your household who is a person of color and you're white, you don't get it until they get stopped by the police for no reason, or no reason that a white person would be picked up, that you have comments in the store that, you know, I can remember when he was younger, people used to follow him around stores. So, I mean, when people say, as Kevin did, that it's different than it was in the 60s, it is different, but it's not that much different. And if you're a person of color, you still have issues. And there's nothing you can do to hide away from it or do anything. No matter where you go, there's going to be some issues. And that is tiring. It's tiring to my son. I'm sure it's tiring to people of all colors, and it's especially tiring to my son because he sees it. It doesn't happen to me. It doesn't happen to his father. It doesn't happen to other relatives. And when you see that on a daily basis, you're confronted with that racism every single day. And it's very upsetting to everyone, including me.
We've got phone lines lighting up here again. You can join the conversation just by calling 263-WXXI. That's 263-9994 or email us at connections@WXXI.org. I have to take a quick break, the shortest break in radio, as your regular host, Evan Dawson, likes to say. We'll be back with Connections in just a moment.
I'm Megan Mack. Tuesday on The Next Connections, local author Alex Sanchez has a new graphic novel for young adults. It's called You Brought Me the Ocean, and it tells the story of a teenager struggling to come out as gay and also as a superhero. We talk to Sanchez about his work. Then in our second hour, we talk with RIT professor Donathan Brown about voting rights in America and policies that impact African-American and Latino voters. Talk to you Tuesday.
You're listening to Connections. I'm David Andrietta, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. And if you're just joining us, we're continuing the series of conversations on this program of how to discuss race and racism. And we're doing it a little bit differently today. We've turned the microphones in on ourselves at WXXI because we wanted to give you a glimpse of the sort of conversations that we're having here. The sometimes difficult, the sometimes uncomfortable, the awkward but rewarding conversations, in the hopes that if you're struggling to facilitate these conversations in your home or workplace, you'll see that we're right there with you and that there is no perfect recipe, that we're all finding our way and we're doing it together. We hope it will be of some help. Our guest this hour, Laura Garrison, Vice President of Development at WXXI and the Little Theater, Tashonda Thomas, Director of Human Resources at WXXI, and Mona Isler, Executive Assistant and Staff Liaison to the WXXI Board. I want to take a call from Stephanie now. Stephanie, you're on the air. Welcome to Connections.
Thank you so much.
What would you like to share?
Do any of you remember Saul Alinsky and Larry Kerwin?
Those names don't ring a bell for me, and it looks from Mona's expression that she may not remember either.
The name's familiar. I know that Saul Alinsky. I know I've heard.
Tell us about them.
Yeah, they were they founded Fight and Fight On back in the 60s. And they work to get housing, Fight Square, and low-cost housing. And also part of the group got together and formed, got to talk to companies in Rochester and said, look, we need you to hire minorities. And I worked for Lawyers Co-op back at that time. And what we did was we opened up jobs for minority people, and they worked for generations there until finally it's closed. Lawyers Co-op and Thomson Reuters has closed down and left the city. And I myself and my husband, we decided instead of having a third child to adopt. And we adopted a little girl who was German, American Indian, and Afro-American. And we had quite a time when we went down south and threatened to get lynched. But up here, she has been accepted very well. The only thing is that when her parents came over from Germany, her mother was German, the interesting thing is that his parents said, it's not going to work. It's just not going to work here. You can't have this biracial child. So sadly, they did give her up. But lucky for us, we got her. That was 50 years ago. So there's just so much more going on. But I want to see companies put their money where their mouth is and open up jobs. And there is one man, and I can't remember his name, but he removed himself from a prominent company's board and specified that a black person had to take that spot on the board. Let's see a little more of that. Let's see President Trump do that. Another president. And I better just be quiet now.
Stephanie, thank you so much for the call. I think what Stephanie may be talking about here is allyship. This is a term that has come up in our talks. It's something I'm hearing a lot more about. Tashonda, do you have a good sense of what allyship is and how it's being used in these conversations today?
Yeah, so for me, allyship, it means a lot. You know, it means someone who doesn't look like me, but is standing right beside me and fighting for the same, you know, causes as me. So we want justice, we want peace, and we want things to be, you know, equality, essentially, right? But it's also those allies having conversations with people that don't look like me, but look like them, that may not listen to me, but they will be more amped to listen to them because they look alike. And so I think that's probably more important. I mean, it's just, you know, is as important as them standing with me, but also when I'm not there, they're still fighting that fight with me. So to me, that's kind of my definition of allyship.
Is there corporate allyship too? Getting back to what Stephanie was talking, making sure that companies open up jobs where the priority is to hire people of color.
Absolutely. I think there's a responsibility in organizations and companies can have their social responsibility. But again, you know, a lot we see is that they'll send out this statement to the public or to their people on where they stand. But you'll look at their board or their top tier leadership and there's no one of color. And so there's kind of a disconnect there where you start to question, well, you say you stand for this, but we just don't see it. So I know the person that she's talking about, I can't think of his name, but I know he's married to Serena Williams, that gave up his board seat and said, you know, specifically, we need someone African American to kind of take my seat. So it's things like that, but it's also a commitment to say, hey, you know, we really need to exhaust our resources to make sure that our leadership is diverse because diversity and inclusion is important. You know, we have all different backgrounds and cultures and great creative ideas that collectively will be great to push an organization's mission statement or strategic plan forward.
I heard, and for our listeners, we have Mona Isler in the studio, Tashonda Thomas and Laura Garrison are with us by phone. So it's sometimes difficult, especially for the untested radio show hosts like me, to catch those verbal or visual cues. I can see Mona nodding her head. She wants to say something, and I think Laura a moment ago said yes and seemed to be in agreement with Tashonda. Do you want to add anything, Mona?
Honestly, I would have said exactly what Tashonda said, verbatim. It's hard to add to what is already perfect. The only thing I would say about corporate allyship is it is not about hiring people and bringing people into your organization to have diversity for diversity's sake. It is about bringing in a diversity of ideas and a diversity of experiences and thoughts. Because one of the things we talked about in our group is, and I talk to people about this all the time, is though you and I may have grown up on the exact same street, next door to each other, our houses were the same, we went to the same school, our experiences in life are different. And the way that we look at the world is different. The way the world looks at us is different. And so it is about diversity of, have you thought about this? Or my experience is this. It's not just about having black and brown people at your table, although that's critical. It's critical because of the diversity of thought and experiences that are going to help form conversations around your boardroom table and around your executive table.
Right. We talked about this in my group, too. And, you know, I'll just open the door here as editor of City. One of the questions is, you know, what can we do more of here at WXXI or at City or at the Little or wherever to to be allies. And one of them, I said, "Oh, I'd like to have more black voices in the newspaper." And you'd said to me, "Well, there are plenty of black voices. You can just go on the street and talk to them."
I'm saying,
but that's not what I was getting at. I was getting at the writers. We're looking for writers,
right,
reporters of color who can bring those diversity of ideas that you are talking mm-hmm. about here. Mona, you said that you've been talking about race, that you're tired, for as long as you can remember, and that as long as you can remember, it's been part of the visibility of your race has been part of your daily experience. Now, not everyone, of course, identifies with their race or approaches conversations about race in that same way. So what do people gain or lose when race is invisible to them? And what do they gain or lose when race is perhaps hyper visible? Just, you know, the two extremes.
So I'm a mother of two wonderful adult children who are they're just the light of my life. I am an executive assistant. I'm an improviser. I love to do math puzzles. I travel the world extensively. And anyone who walks up to me on the street knows none of that. The only thing they know is that I'm a black woman. That's the first thing that anyone sees when they see me. So the concept of I don't see color, I am colorblind, completely erases what I think is the most beautiful part about me and a part of who I am as a person. So I always tell people, when people say, I don't see color, I'm colorblind, you're erasing me, you're making me invisible.
Well, that's the extension of privilege too, right?
Right. And because you don't need to think about it, but I do need to think about it. It's there. It's in front of me all the time. So the danger is that a person loses the ability to see me fully and wholly as a person, because being a black woman is the most important part of who I am. All that other stuff came after. I've been this since I was born.
Well, and it's shaped your experience.
It's shaped
right?
my entire
everything.
Everything. So, I just read an article about how to navigate white workplaces as a black woman. And the author said something that I thought was extremely important. She was like, you know, you feel a sense of invisibility and hypervisibility all the time. It's just a back and forth. And she said, you find that your blackness is always on display while also feeling constantly ignored and alienated by the whiteness surrounding you. It's the hypervisibility that propels white people to involve law enforcement when they perceive black people to be criminal, suspicious, or not as belonging to particular spaces. It's the hypervisibility that forces women of color to change their tone or be less direct, change their hair, and direct communication, or change the inflection in the way that they speak in order not to be perceived as angry, hostile, or sassy, etc. So the problem with being hypervisible is that people then are assigning things to you based on the color of your skin, based on what they see and the perceptions that they bring to our interactions, just because they only see the color. So those are sort of the dichotomy of, you know, being a black woman.
Laura mentioned on her reading list Ibram X. Kendi's work. Who wrote that?
Oh, her name, I will find out for you.
We'll come back to it. So, Tashonda or Laura, I'll throw this out to you. How do we find the space between the extremes of invisibility and hypervisibility when it comes to race? How do you navigate that territory and bring everyone into that room?
Well, I think that for me...
Go ahead, Laura.
So I think that for me, the important thing is that white people learn about what it means to be racist and what it means to be a person of color and have that in your face every single day. And I think that, you know, I think that you certainly, my son is very proud of his heritage, and every person of color should be extraordinarily proud of their heritage. They've got great heritage, just like I'm proud of my heritage. But the key is that everybody needs to be treated equally. And you can't start treating people equally until you acknowledge that there's an issue and that needs to be corrected. And I think that by educating yourself about what racism is and what is really happening out there is an important thing to do. So doing some reading, looking around, talking to people, I think that's really important. I'm very proud of the fact that WXXI has put together these listening sessions because I think it's so important, and especially for people who are white. People of color understand they're people of color. They know it. They know racism. They experience it every day. People who are white don't get it a lot of times. And I think that you need to figure it out. You need to get it. And then you need to be an anti-racist, which means you're fighting every day to stop racism, to promote equality among everyone.
Thank you, Laura. Sierra Graham was the author of the article that Mona was just referring to. That's Sierra with a C-I-E-R-A Graham. You know, one of the questions that came up in our listening session that made me a little squeamish was how we can personally take responsibility to improve race relations or be an agent of change for racial equity. And it was squeamish to me because it got me thinking about situations in which I've confronted racism or been met with racism but not confronted it. And typically, I am not in situations where I am feeling that the people I'm talking to are overtly racist. I don't consort with friends of that nature. My colleagues are not like that. Where it happens with me is it seems to be in casual conversations. And why it's squeamish is because what do you say when it's a conversation that's in passing? I'll give you an example. I was at a youth sports event, and I was with just making conversations with an older gentleman, an older white gentleman, who saw one of his grandchildren with his hat on backwards, and he said, "Turn that hat around, Billy." His name wasn't Billy. "Turn that hat around, Billy. You look like one of those kids from the city." And it troubled me, I think for obvious reasons, because it seemed to me like I knew what he was talking about. I knew what he was getting at. This was an otherwise pleasant conversation up until that point. I'm not interested in getting into a deep conversation on the sidelines. I'm not interested necessarily in putting someone in their place, so to speak. And if you could see me now, listeners, I mean, I'm wincing. I don't know what to do in situations like this. And these are the types of conversations that we have had here at WXXI, and that I'm just sharing with you on a personal note. So, what is the right thing to do? Would anyone like to answer that? Mona, Tashonda, Laura, I'm serious. Mm-hmm. What is the right thing to do?
So I'll jump in there.
Sure.
So for me, I think that is the perfect opportunity to have the conversation with him. So I know that these conversations are not comfortable. No one wants to have them, but, you know, put yourself in someone of color's place. So if there was a child that was in earshot of what he said that was from the city, how do you think that would have made he or she feel? So I think, you know, again, we have responsibility to educate and take all of these uncomfortable moments and look at them as a teachable moment. And I'm not saying even if you would have engaged with him deeper to say, hey, you know, what you just said could be offensive, or it is offensive, would have changed how he thought. But at least you spoke up for what was right. Because as Mona said, we are born Black, and we don't have the opportunity all the time to walk away or step away from things that are, you know, when we're done wrong or when something's said to us. We can't escape being Black. We deal with this 24/7 all the time. So for us, it's kind of like, okay, we are always kind of, on the defensive when these things happen, because we always feel like we have to be in protect mode or defense mode. But again, going back to that word that we kept using today, allyship, we need people like you, Dave, to say, hey, you know, that was offensive, because me and Mona talking to him, it just won't be perceived the same way.
I had said to Mona in that listening session, I didn't use that example in a listening session, but, you used another, but And I wondered, you know, why is it, like, do I have something tattooed on my forehead that lets people think that they can have that conversation with me? What sort of vibe am I giving off that this person would be comfortable saying that? Because I suspect that person wouldn't be comfortable saying that to you, to Shonda, as a black woman, to Mona as a black woman, or a black man. But for some reason, you know, I'm on the sidelines of a youth sporting event. This person feels that they can say that to me. Mona.
So the dominant culture, color is invisible to them. So the fact that you are white, that you look like him, he leads with you are compatible in thought and the way that you process things. He leads with the fact that because you look like him, you also think like him. And that he would be able to have to say, make a microaggression like that about putting your hat backwards. But it is your responsibility to check that. And one of the things we talked about in terms of what we can do, what it is about forming, you are have to work on your own inner circle. And I use the analogy we talk about in terms of wearing your masks all the time. I wear my mask because I'm protecting my circle. I'm protecting those around me, my parents, my kids, I'm protecting my circle. And being an ally is about educating your circle.
It is now, that being said, I wouldn't put this person in my circle.
Well,
but I get where you're going.
Your where you can influence. And like she said, you may not change his mind, but an ally fights even when I'm not there.
Right.
And it's funny because the term ally, the Latin comes from to bind. You are coming alongside me, my cause, and you are fighting with me even though you don't have my direct experience. You are going to come alongside me, bind with me in my cause, and fight even when I'm not there.
Speaking of fighting for causes, we have Doris in Rochester on the line. Doris moved to Rochester in the mid-1970s and participated in anti-racist demonstrations. She wants to tell us about those. Hi, Doris. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. And thank you for I didn't know about these listening sessions, but it sounds like you're doing a lot of good work and especially listening to people. My contribution, what I would like to say a few things about is, first of all, a number of things have been mentioned about the history and after the riots, the number of very important initiatives, including hiring more minorities at Kodak and Xerox.
And you're referring to the 64 riots.
Right, 64 riots. So when I arrived in the 70s, I moved into the 19th Ward, a very integrated neighborhood, and a lot of my neighbors worked at Xerox and worked at Kodak, and I think that was very, very important to break through on a lot of that. On the downside, that I noticed as time went on, there were a lot of lawsuits about prejudice and discrimination at those places in terms of advancement and promotions. And it reminded me that you can legislate certain things, but it's much harder to change people's hearts. As we go forward, I think this is a wonderful opportunity. I've been involved in a lot of things over the years. My main purpose in life, I felt, was to be a teacher, and I'm a teacher of African American history, and I taught that in other places and other times, and it got to a point where nobody wanted to. People really felt that African American history should only be taught by African Americans, and I think that affirmative action was really great, but I think that to really move forward, we have to come together as a community. So working together with a lot of people who feel that African-American history is important. I think, for me, the end game has to be integration. My hope is that as more and more families find themselves integrated, that it's harder and harder to continue with the kind of everyday racism that people of color experience and just knowing more people. And I think that a lot of people understand this, that because we're so segregated, and I have to say I've been so distraught about the past few years that we've become
sure.
more and more segregated. So I think integration is the way, and the means is community, developing different projects and working together.
Doris, I thank you so much for that, for offering that perspective and that historical analysis there. We have to, I had to end the call. We're getting close to the end of the hour, and I want to give to Shonda the last word here about any advice she would have for HR directors anywhere, the biggest companies, the smallest businesses, to what is the value that you have found in these listening sessions that we've had, and how would you suggest they go about it? We have about a minute and a half.
So I definitely recommend that they do this. You can call it whatever you want, listening session, town hall meetings. But the importance of this is that you will be able to connect with your staff on a completely different level beyond, you know, what their role is and what your expectations is as it relates to their job. I think that culturally you'll change things for the better. And again, it'll show that you support your staff truly in everything that's going on around them, even outside of the workplace.
And it seems to me that it's just important to simply launch the discussion, you know,
I mean,
to just get
the right
it,
thing.
Just get it off
right.
the ground, right?
Exactly.
You know, reduce the anxiety by just talking about it anyway, because it's there.
Yeah.
I want to thank each and every one of my guests for opening up to me and to listeners today and having this conversation, as awkward as it may have been at times on the air, to give our listeners an idea of what we're doing here at WXXI, but hopefully break the ice for them going forward. To Shonda Thomas, Director of HR here at WXXI, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Laura Garrison, Vice President of Development at WXXI and the Little Theater, I really appreciate you being here, Laura.
My pleasure.
And Mona Isler, Executive Assistant and doer of all things around WXXI.
It's
thank you
true,
so.
Though.
It is true. Thank you so much for being here today.
It was such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm David Andrietta, in for Evan Dawson. Evan should be back tomorrow, so tune into Connections. Thank you very much for listening.